So when I look across the sort of political spectrum, there is something from Bitcoin that kind of relates to all of the parties. It's not whether you're left or right, or, you know, from the wealthy or the poor side. There is an aspect of this that touches everybody, because money does.
Hello, I am Cody Ullingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Kevin Whitmore, chairperson of the Bitcoin Policy Institute, New Zealand. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Back on November 12th, the Institute had its official launch event in the New Zealand capital of Wellington. And along with sharing its first tax policy paper, it was really our first chance to talk publicly about the work we're doing with the Bitcoin Policy Institute. Obviously, I'm also a founding member. It's a very exciting time. I mean, we had a great turnout with the launch event. I met some leaders from the Bitcoin community. We had industry, we had government, including a Minister for Courts and Associate Minister for Justice, Nicole McKee, MPs Joseph Mooney, Greg Fleming, and Cameron Luxton. But Kev, I thought we could maybe start with a little bit of a background to the Institute and what led us to forming this organization?
Yeah, good question. I think this has been a long time coming. A lot of other countries have their own Bitcoin Policy Institute. So looking at the US, the UK, there's the Canada Coalition over there for Bitcoin, and similarly with Australia. So I think our lens came through discussions with the other BPI organizations globally. So leveraging what they do. So yeah, that was probably the starting point, was connecting in with them. But then it was also, just as most Bitcoin things are, it was pretty grassroots. I think a few of us knew each other already from the BitKiwi events, but also other spaces, Lightning Pay, et cetera, have been a good supporter. So yeah, like most Bitcoin organizations, it was pretty ground up grassroots.
Yeah. I guess, though, in this engagement space with the New Zealand government in particular, I mean, there have been other organizations taking a swing at this, but there wasn't really a dedicated voice for Bitcoin, was there?
No, and I think that's probably something that's I see as helpful, is when you come at it purely from a monetary lens. A lot of the rest of the topics and potential noise quietens down, and you can sort of focus in on that exclusive topic, which is good, because that obviously in itself is massive, right? It has huge impact across New Zealand and society. So it's been good to focus in on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have been talking about this for a while, and I know the Institute, we officially incorporated back in July of this year, and we had sort of been percolating around the way forward, and it seemed like a policy paper was sort of the natural first step, right, to kind of help us have some sort of output. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that, because at this launch event last week we had the announcement of our tax policy paper, and this was quite an interesting experience trying to sort of forecast forward what we think is the best pathway for Bitcoin adoption in New Zealand. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that, how that policy paper came about and how it was received.
Yeah, I think initial discussions were where do we start with all of this? Do we create sort of a Bitcoin NZ umbrella and then have sort of offshoots that people want to lead? And I think the resounding feedback from the now members of the Institute was, we need a policy voice, and that's to help guide people forming policy in this space from more of an informed perspective. There's a lot of narratives out there, obviously, in the mainstream media, and we kind of wanted to create a place where people can come and get a non-partisan kind of feedback that's well researched, etc. So initially, yeah, we thought, do we go for sort of the umbrella thing? But no, we went straight for policy. And even within that context as well, I think we were going to attempt three policies initially, and realized let's start with the most important one, or the most pertinent in the current climate. And that happened to be de minimis tax exemption. And that's specifically to address the monetary use case of Bitcoin, which we can delve into a little bit more.
Yeah. So I am keen to dive into that. I guess having gone through that process with yourself and the committee to kind of end up at that place where that was the policy we wanted to focus on, really the resounding theme was Bitcoin is money. And it's sort of a statement, right? It is what Bitcoin was originally designed for, and it's the way we think is the way forward, right? It's to treat Bitcoin as money and to be able to use it as money. And it was quite an interesting journey, I must say, just going through this process of, okay, where do we put our resources? Because as you say, we are a grassroots organization, as 7 committee members and, small, humble team. And there could have been a lot of places we put our energy, but it seemed as if policy was the one that would have the most cut through. And perhaps we could just, before we go into the specifics of the policy, just kind of talking a little bit about why this engagement is important and what it means to be operating at a policy level, because maybe a lot of people don't quite know what that means, you know, how laws and regulations actually come into being. But what is the importance of a policy lens, do you think?
Yeah, so I guess previously, so I was at Callaghan Innovation prior to this, and connecting with a lot of the people that work in other government departments, but also in the central bank as well. There's a lot of people doing some really good things in these spaces. And so a lot of them look to people with the ability to guide them in areas, especially around their own policies. But I think what we learned was we need to be talking to the politicians, the members of parliament, the parties themselves. They're ultimately the ones that are going to drive the laws, the regulations, kind of from that level. Ultimately, the departments themselves will implement off the back of the policies and the laws and the legislation that's created. Yeah, from our perspective, I think policy was important because unless we're able to change the way in which Bitcoin is currently perceived and regulated, it's going to be very hard to drive adoption, but also take advantage of the opportunities as a country here as well.
Yeah, I think it's quite exciting as well that for such a small country that the fact that at our launch event we had, 3 MPs and a minister in attendance, and very excited to be there, as well, along with other, stakeholders, other people working in government and industry. I think it's a very good sign, I think, that we were able to have that much engagement on effectively a grassroots budget, let's say. And with the resources we've had, we've had those engagements. There is an appetite for learning more, it seems, from ministers and from politicians, right? That they recognize that Bitcoin is qualitatively different to maybe broader cryptocurrency conversations. They recognize that there is an opportunity here for New Zealand. And so I think maybe, what are your thoughts on that opportunity for a smaller country like New Zealand to actually have meaningful engagement?
Yeah, and maybe just to touch on your previous point as well, I do think we're really lucky. And I think you saw there's a promotion happening happening in the US at the moment. Square currently promoting a de minimis tax policy over there in terms of addressing their capital gains kind of challenges in the US. And their process over there is quite different. They're encouraging everybody to write to their local congressman to kind of generate that momentum. Here we can just get in the room with people, and I think we're quite fortunate to be able to do that. So obviously trade-offs being a small country, but also opportunities as well. So very, very appreciative for the MPs that made it to the launch event the other day, being able to discuss that with them. So from my perspective, just really good to be able to touch base with them and connect with them and have those conversations. I think also to your point around Bitcoin as money as well, yeah, it depends on the people that we talk to. I think some of them kind of get that there is a difference in that context. Some of them don't, but that's part of our our remit now is to kind of help them and assist them and sort of educate where we can in a hands-off kind of way.
Yeah, and it feels like the timing is quite right. I mean, I certainly, Kev, we've been talking about this, you and me, for a little while now about sort of the opportunities for this kind of engagement. But it seems globally, what's happening in the United States, what's happening with Bitcoin generally has led to a situation now where perhaps the conversation is a little bit easier to have. And so it seems like the timing's really good, that there is a global moment for Bitcoin, and in particular the treatment coming out of it in the US as a kind of a bit of a North Star for a potential approach. It's here to stay, you know. It's showing its longevity, and so it seems like a really good timing to have an institute that's ready to talk about Bitcoin as money with New Zealand politicians.
Yeah, and I think as some of them have already alluded, you know, maybe New Zealand doesn't lead all of these things, but we also don't want to be lagging behind. So there is definitely people are watching what's happening in the US. They are seeing that, you know, Senator Lummis is proposing a de minimis tax bill over there. There's a lot more movement in the space around those sorts of things. So we're able to now have those conversations locally around the definition of Bitcoin as property at the moment, and whether it's still applicable that these things should be only taxed as speculative assets or not.
Yeah. So just jumping into the tax policy, which we presented at the launch event on November 12th, this was it was quite exciting to work on this. We put together a three-page white paper for that, which is available on the website, nzbitcoin.org. But jumping into this idea, de minimis tax exemption for Bitcoin payments under $1,000 New Zealand, let's sort of step through what does this mean, and what's sort of the vision for this?
Sure. So first of all, why $1,000? So, I mean, we are looking at what's happening overseas. Again, the US bill that's kind of been proposed is $600 de minimis tax exemption in US dollars, which is roughly, you know, a similar number and equates to $1,000 New Zealand. So that's kind of the reasoning there. So de minimis tax exemption is basically what it says is it's a tax exemption for, and the way we've worded this is everyday payments. So anything that you might buy, groceries, paying for bills, anything, you know, clothing, retail type things, a coffee, etc. Currently, the process is if you spend any Bitcoin at all, it is treated as property, and because of that, you have to calculate the price at which you bought the Bitcoin originally, the price at which you disposed of it, and calculate whether that was a net gain or a net loss. And then as part of your your income tax declaration each year, you have to declare the loss or the gain in terms of that. So in terms of everyday payments for people that are using it as money, it becomes very cumbersome to basically record all of those transactions, record all of the changes, and then to post that at the end of year. So that is in itself a deterrent for people to actually use it. I know a lot of people that will then just, you know, store it as opposed to use it as money. And our argument is, yeah, the reason why it's being defined as property is because people can't use it as money. So let's update our tax legislation to exclude small payments for everyday use cases. And that can potentially unlock a whole bunch of new opportunities, not just for New Zealanders individually, but also for businesses, for new fintechs, for new innovative opportunities, etc.
Yeah, and coming back to the launch event, it was quite an awesome event. It was at a place called Shushu on the Wellington waterfront, a really idyllic location just next to the National Museum Te Papa. And the venue accepts Bitcoin payments, right? So we were able to buy drinks for the MPs and, you know, these other guests and show them the Bitcoin Lightning Network in operation and natively at the venue, right? And I thought that was quite a kind of awesome way to demonstrate what Bitcoin payments actually mean, right?
Yeah, it was funny. Some people, because we were using kind of a PayWave equivalent with the bulk cards, I'm not sure it had as dramatic effect as some people expect versus a wallet kind of usage. But yeah, we were basically tapping these bulk cards to pay for drinks, etc. So people could see in real time the transactions being made, which was really good. Proving that the use case for it was real.
Yeah, well, and it's sort of, in a sense, it was a frictionless experience. And so we were lucky all of our committee members were able to come to the event. So we were able to talk people through sort of what was happening and the fact that, you know, the server behind this, the BTC Pay server, that is, it's a New Zealand company that's operating this infrastructure that is working here to provide this technology to this venue that effectively opens things up to the world, right? You're now part of a global monetary network when you use the Lightning Network. And so there was quite a cool experience, and I could see the sort of people's, you know, talking to a few people, it was ticking over in their minds. I think, okay, what's going on here? Because it's not touching those legacy rails. It's a whole new thing, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. they just maybe hadn't considered that before, you know, Bitcoin as money.
Yeah, and that's part of our process is to start educating them, right?
But yeah, coming back to this de minimis exemption, the other part of it, which I thought was quite interesting, where we sort of, you know, obviously our committee had a lot of conversations and we did a lot of work. We talked with, very kindly, people gave their time to talk to us and give us input on this. The other part of it was the compliance aspect and the fact that for every coffee, for every single transaction, having that record of cost basis and disposal cost and all of that actually creates a real burden for the Inland Revenue Department as well in New Zealand. That, and what are they going to do with all that information? The fact that it's sort of almost overwhelming means that the compliance isn't really able to be enforced, and it makes everyone look bad in a sense, right? There's this the sense that it's not being looked at, if you were to give that.
And yeah. I think that was part of our feedback at the event as well, was I think one of the surveys that had been conducted said 70% of people that answered weren't compliant at the moment. And I think there's an opportunity to make them compliant or improve the process when you reduce the burden. So anything above $1,000, absolutely declared in terms of capital gains, etc. But ideally, those transactions, especially for somebody that's just using Bitcoin as money, should be a lot less. So the onus on the user is still obviously to do all of that, but just from a reduced perspective. And our expectation is that compliance will then improve based on, you know, reduced complexity to have to declare everything.
Yeah, and there becomes a clear line with which disposal, you know, selling larger sums of Bitcoin into New Zealand dollars, of course, that is an event that requires some tax recording and there is compliance required there. But for buying that coffee and participating in the economy, by removing that burden, as you say, that sort of frees up people to actually account for the meaningful transactions which actually have a tax take for the government. And so it is a win-win if we can get higher, more compliance on those higher value disposals into New Zealand dollars, as opposed to nickel and diming everybody for every coffee that's actually just participating in the economy as money, right?
Yeah, and I think the other opportunity that people might not be aware of as well is the Bitcoin network itself. So using that as the rails. So I think one of our points at the launch event was New Zealand pays, you know, some of the highest merchant fees globally in terms of payment, merchant fees, payment fees, etc., and interbank fees as well. So one of the things that they've launched in the US at the moment has been on Strike's agenda for the last 6 years, I think Jack Mallers said, was to be able to use the Bitcoin network for exchanging like currency to like currency. So what that means is over there now you can actually pay with US dollars using the Bitcoin network. So you pay in US dollars, the merchant receives US dollars by using the Bitcoin network to facilitate that transaction. And so the fees basically disappear. So that's quite transformative in terms of reducing fees at the till and point of sale. So merchants benefit, users benefit, technology opportunities open up in terms of innovative new solutions for these sorts of things. So yeah, there's Bitcoin the asset, there's Bitcoin the network. And I think as we start to educate people on all of the opportunities, we can start to tick off or answer some of the problems that exist, especially in New Zealand, around the fees and challenges we have at point of payment.
Yeah, and I mean, this was a very real experience for me coming back to New Zealand for a few weeks and using a couple of overseas neobanks that, for a variety of reasons, sometimes it was just easier to do the pay wave, tap and pay, and I don't fully understand what was happening. Sometimes the PIN wasn't working, and I ended up paying quite a few surcharges, which I don't fully understand, because I believe there was a bill before Parliament to reduce the surcharges on consumers, but I was still paying,
hasn't come into effect yet.
Okay, so I see.
It's been passed, but yeah, it'll still be the merchant that has to pay. Yeah. So yeah,
they'll be passing those costs on to consumers, no doubt, because things are pretty tough out there, right? So it sort of doesn't really solve the problem in a sense. It just moves it around. And as I said, I was regularly, these were like 30 cent, 50 cent, $1 surcharges for PayWave, which is just kind of ridiculous. And in many situations, those are just being siphoned off to Australian banks or other entities. And I mean, effectively, it is a rent-seeking situation, right? And so having something that disrupts that seems quite valuable, I think, for New Zealand.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, the other part of this, which I think you talked about a little bit in your speech at the event, was the history of New Zealand's financial innovation, because many people don't realise New Zealand was a leader once upon a time with the rollout of FPOS, which is, digital card payments. Back in the 90s, I believe, there was the move to using, swipe cards and bank cards in New Zealand. And that was leading the way for a while when a lot of countries were still on cash. And that sort of innovation seemed to have sort of had a peak in the 90s, early 2000s. And yet here we are today, where most of that network is overseas, foreign owned. We've kind of left the innovation behind. So what are your thoughts on that innovation side with payments?
Yeah, so although we didn't obviously create FPOS per se, we were definitely an early adopter. I think it was 89 that we originally kind of launched with that properly. And I think part of this is kind of social customary things. You adopt a technology, it kind of proliferates and everybody gets on that as a standard. So moving off a standard collectively tends to be quite hard. So I understand that. Any sort of innovation we've had tends to be slightly iterative in terms of PayWave. But again, that comes through MasterCard, Visa, overseas kind of channels, etc. So all those fees go offshore. I think an open standard like Bitcoin evens the playing field, right? It means that we get to create our own solutions internally, compete on price, but also different products as well. It's all pretty exciting. And I think the more people understand that this is just the beginning, would be good.
Well, there's also an opportunity in a wide variety of situations within government and policy. I know historically it was a case that Australia was often looking at what New Zealand was doing to take a sort of policy leadership. Because again, New Zealand is a smaller country. It's a little bit more nimble in some ways. And yet now we're seeing a situation within Asia Pacific where Australia is perhaps locking down a little bit. There's a little bit more bureaucracy. It's harder to get things done. And so there is maybe an opportunity here for New Zealand to actually be leading the way again and to be, in a sense, an innovator. And one of the statistics I quoted at the launch event was that there's more Bitcoin accepting merchants in Queenstown than in Hong Kong, and that there's more in Christchurch than there is in Singapore. And these are two Asian financial centres that are, you know, bigger than New Zealand in the case of Hong Kong, yet we've got more merchants in one city in New Zealand than Hong Kong. And so there is this maybe opportunity for New Zealand here at the bottom of the world to lead the way, right, with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And those statistics probably won't last forever. So time, you know, time is of the essence in terms of those sorts of things. So, yeah, you saw what happened with Square. They released their Bitcoin products basically to 4 million merchants overnight. So suddenly when you have that reach and are able to kind of distribute it that fast, New Zealand kind of has an opportunity to do things on our own terms, or we can wait for the others to kind of give it to us again.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think this question, I mean, you mentioned some of your work with Callaghan Innovation previously, looking at New Zealand technology innovation and R&D and this kind of stuff. And I mean, the fact is that there is a brain drain, there is an innovation drain out of New Zealand. It's harder to do stuff in many cases. And so, I mean, it seems prudent policy, prudent approach to make it easier to do things here and to have the facilities for that kind of financial innovation, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
No, we only get these kind of opportunities, really, and you either take them and you adopt a sort of forward-looking approach, or, again, you'll get it given to you and charged for it in the future.
Yeah. And then the other piece, so we've put this policy paper together. I mean, this has been circulating. Again, this is public on the website. I'm certainly keen to hear feedback. Anyone listening who's got any thoughts or ideas, definitely reach out. But, I mean, this is just the beginning of the process, right? I mean, to actually enact, to become policy, to become law, there's much more consultation and process involved. But, where do you see things going from here with this policy paper?
Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing to see so many people, well, first feedback their thoughts on it, which has been really, really helpful, because again, we're not here to sort of, you know, unilaterally say this is the way. We're here to draft something up, get feedback, and evolve it for New Zealand. So that's been really, really helpful. But also, I guess, from a political sphere as well, not just the politicians themselves, but also government departments have been very supportive. So I think now is the time for dialogue. I've been meeting with quite a few MPs one-on-one, but also discussions with tax lawyers, government departments, etc. And yeah, so I'm really optimistic. I think now's the time to start with this as kind of a straw man as to how we might impact policy in the future. And if we can get this one over the line and continue to get this passed, this will set a precedent for, you know, how we evolve this space in the future. And I know it's a challenging space. It touches many, many different aspects, from energy usage to cybersecurity to inflation to monetary policy. There's all these sorts of things. And we just want to be part of that discussion in a sort of a non-partisan, think tanky way.
Yeah, understood. And I think the other part of it, we've taken inspiration from some of these other policy institutes, right? But certainly with the caliber and quality of our committee and our associates, the appreciation of exactly how government works and how these things work has been really useful. And as you say, to get attention in the United States, I mean, it is challenging. You know, you have to spend a lot of money, and there's a lot of resources spent on getting the attention of politicians, whereas here in New Zealand, through our professional connections, we're able to have those conversations and be at the table and meet these people where they're at. And I think I'm really excited about that. I tell people, you know, that we had a minister, you know, and three, you know, several MPs at our event, and I mean, to get to that level with any other country, I mean, it would be quite a challenge. And so there is an opportunity for New Zealand that we can work together to make the conditions favorable to use Bitcoin as money as intended, and then along the way many benefits, because I mean, the other piece you mentioned, even energy, certainly New Zealand has an opportunity alongside all of the money stuff to export Bitcoin, right, and to be mining Bitcoin sustainably with hydropower, for example. And that, I mean, that's just a whole new space, right, for the economy.
Well, I think the other thing as well is, I mean, the biggest probably opportunity I see as well is New Zealand has a housing challenge, right? And we put all our money into houses as kind of our monetary, our money inflates, and the dollar kind of debases. You know, those that can put their money into houses, despite it having sort of a utility function, it's used predominantly as a store of wealth. And now we've actually got an opportunity to store our wealth in a different asset. So when I look across the sort of political spectrum, there is something from Bitcoin that kind of relates to all of the parties. It's not whether you're left or right, or you know, from the wealthy or the poor side. There is an aspect of this that touches everybody, because money does. And that's kind of what excites me, is that this can be quite neutral and nonpartisan, as opposed to one party championing it and one sort of being against it, etc. They might have different reasons for championing it, but I think collectively it's quite an exciting kind of opportunity for everybody.
Yeah, it's very complimentary, I think, as you say, and it is a bipartisan undertaking. The other thing I wanted to touch on, Kevin, was certainly at the launch event, I had some conversations with people about stablecoins and the opportunity and challenges that exist with stablecoins, in particular US-denominated stablecoins. And so I thought we could talk a little bit about sort of that, because you know, Bitcoin is qualitatively different. It is neutral. It doesn't have a sovereign state attached to it compared to stablecoins. But yeah, what are your thoughts on how stablecoins figure into this whole conversation?
Yeah, I've had quite a few conversations as well. And I think it's, yeah, without trying to be alarmist, I think people are underestimating it being a little bit of a Trojan horse. I mean, obviously, with the Genius Act being passed in the US, that allows the US now to basically export more dollars through stablecoins globally and potentially offset some of their debt. One of the things that obviously you see a lot of in countries where they're either going through serious inflation or hyperinflation is with the likes of US stablecoins, people are now starting to transact in those locally a lot more than their own currency, because why would you hold something that is effectively inflating away? So something like a Tether or a USDT, for example, anybody can hold that now. You can transact with it over your phone. You don't need, you know, bank accounts or rent-seeking middle people. And this often, I guess, surprises people. But when you think about all of the fintech innovation that we have at the moment in terms of, you know, the neobanks, the PayPals, all that sort of stuff, every time you make a payment, you have to have a bank account at one end, at both ends, sorry. So the rails continue to be, I guess, those traditional banking rails, and stablecoins takes that all away. So you can basically transact peer-to-peer with anybody. So that presents the opportunity for, if I'm holding something that's inflating and I have the opportunity to hold a stronger currency, why wouldn't I? So eventually, if that starts to catch on globally, to what degree does that challenge the sovereignty of the New Zealand dollar? I think it does, and I think it's worth thinking about. And then you're basically using locally a currency where all of the monetary policy is being set by a different nation. With Bitcoin, you have the opportunity to transact with a sovereign neutral asset, which, although you don't get to directly impact the monetary policy of Bitcoin, nobody can, right? So it's a neutral entity. So where do you put your chips is kind of a it's kind of worth considering. If you only go down the New Zealand dollar route, and we have challenges from a technology perspective through US stablecoins, do you want to start considering alternatives which provide a neutrality that the others don't?
Yeah, and I think the other piece of that is, even if there were explorations of stable coins that are denominated in New Zealand dollars, looking at the infrastructure and the technology behind that, I've certainly had conversations with people around the ability to use the Lightning Network, the Bitcoin Lightning Network, to run stable coins. And That, you know, there is this race to the bottom in terms of using something like Tron as the blockchain that runs a lot of these stable coins, and that comes with its own challenges because fundamentally the value that's being sent is not connected to the underlying blockchain in that situation. And so there's kind of a mismatch there, which it is a race to the bottom, and there's a lot of security trade-offs, there's a lot of challenges with that. Whereas if you have something running over Lightning that's actually tagged and pegged into Bitcoin, a stablecoin running over Lightning, that maybe is a slow burn, it's a longer project, but you're building that sort of heartwood of the network and the security and all of the values that you get from building on Bitcoin, right? And so there is a conversation there, right, around how you maybe even have something denominated in New Zealand dollars but on Bitcoin.
Yeah, and then I think all the I don't know if you call it a layer three, but the eCash opportunities as well that sits on top, that kind of gets you closer to sort of an FPOS kind of experience. There's just so many opportunities here once people look at it seriously as a technology that you can kind of reform to kind of fit the scenario that you're interested in.
Yeah. So look, it's very exciting with what's happening with the Bitcoin Policy Institute New Zealand, certainly early days. In fact, prior to officially incorporating the society, we also had a really good event at Parliament. That was a couple of months ago now, but maybe just tell us a little bit about that. That was sort of before we formally came together, but that was actually at the House of Parliament, right?
Yeah, so that was led by the Lightning Pay team, who connected with their local MP, Joseph Mooney. So they graciously invited everybody in just to have a discussion. And I know Rob from Lightning Pay brought in his Bitcoin miner, and so officially mined some sats inside of the Beehive, which I think was, he liked to claim was a world first. So we got invited in. It was mostly coalition MPs, and we got to talk about, I guess, some of the concepts around Bitcoin, the opportunities. They had lots of thoughts and feedback. I think Simon from Lightning Pay also handed out some books, the Bitcoin Standard, etc. So again, it was just an informative kind of session held to discuss how these things work, but also the opportunities.
Yeah, and I do understand that one or two of the MPs who attended our event have been reading the Bitcoin Standard, it seems, and picking up a few things here and there, right? And starting to see what we see. So it's quite exciting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other piece was, I think, with that event, I mean, obviously Lightning Pay, in my experience, so this is a New Zealand-based Bitcoin exchange, but much more than that, they could pay your bills using their service, which is quite phenomenal, really. You can set a New Zealand bank account and pay from Lightning, and the money will turn up in that bank account. And there's some of the stuff they're doing, which kind of dovetails quite nicely with, again, New Zealand is a small, nimble country where we can interface with the banking system in a way that's just not possible in the US with all of its different mishmash of state regulations. New Zealand, you can just do stuff. And some of the stuff they're doing at Lightning Pay is quite incredible. And I think, again, I see glimmers of some real innovation there that disrupts quite a lot of what's happening in a good way. And it's really, I think it's a really big success story, and I'd love to see more stuff like that.
Yeah, and I've got a lot of time for the solutions that, answer the gnarly problems, right? And in New Zealand, we've got some pretty gnarly ones. The more time we can spend solving them, the better.
Yeah. All right. So just with come back to the Institute then, Kev. What are sort of next steps then from here? I mean, we had this launch event. It was a big success. What do you think we can expect? What's on the horizon for the next couple of months?
Yeah, so as a team, I think we're going to get together and plan our strategy for the next 12 months. So that's still to be decided, but definitely we want to keep pushing the de minimis tax policy, having conversations. The door is always open for people that have questions. We have access to some amazing people that work in the energy space, climate activists that know this space inside out. Like, it was a great example at the event when somebody was asking some energy questions, and Sam Keevy from GridShare was able to stand up and answer all those on the spot, right? And he was just wasn't expecting that. But again, access to people with hands-on knowledge is really good. So yeah, expect us to be spending more time answering questions, spending more time with politicians that want to write or want to have a policy in this space that people can get their head around and understand where their position is. And so we're encouraging, you know, everybody and anybody to come and have a chat.
Yeah.
So our efforts are going to be pretty much in that space over the next 12 months.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. So look, as I said, I'm involved with this institute as well. Very exciting times. If anyone wants to reach out, of course, check out the website nzbitcoin.org or email through to the committee info@nzbitcoin.org. But otherwise, we might wrap it up there, Kev. I think we covered the gist of it. And yeah, really exciting times. Thank you so much for your time.
All good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.